Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. On the programme, remembering Brendan Behan, 50 years after his death.
To begin the morning, the ward are bawling. Get out of bed and clean up your cell. And the old triangle went jingle jangle along the banks of the Royal Canal.
The unmistakable voice there of Brendan Behan, fresh and original as it was more than half a century ago. Hard to believe it's almost exactly 50 years since his death on the 20th of March 1964. I'm sure many a St. Patrick's Day and night he enlivened and cast a quizzical eye upon. Tonight we consider his writing for stage, page, poetry and public platform, and pay a small tribute to his memory and his literary legacy. In this year of anniversary, we ask, how well does his work endure, and is due attention being given to it? We'll hear later from Behan's niece Janet and from director Adrian Dunbar on Behan's theatrical legacy. But first, Behan scholar Dr. John Brannigan of University College Dublin. How does he assess Brendan Behan's work 50 years on from his too early death?
I think he's very original and very distinctive as a writer. He's a very experimental writer. And I think his reputation will really stand on the two major plays, The Queer Fellow and The Hostage, and his autobiographical novel, Borstal Boy. I think in particular, if you look at The Queer Fellow, it's an extraordinary play, which should really make you laugh and make the hair on the back of your neck stand on end at the same time. The accounts of the first production in Dublin in 1954 record how audiences came out in a cold sweat. And it's ostensibly an anti-hanging play, but it's written as a comedy. And that's characteristic of Behan's kind of paradoxical way of working. It's a very serious political play, but Behan also wanted to defy, if you like, the regime of prison and the regime of social class in society by showing you a vibrant working class culture. And he does that through comedy and through song. The Hostage, likewise, I think, is it's a party of a play, and yet it should be a tense political thriller. It's set in an IRA safe house, which is also a brothel in the Monto district in Dublin. And an English soldier is held hostage and will be executed in reprisal for the execution of an IRA prisoner held in Belfast. But Behan again turns this into a comedy and turns it into a play about plural identities, plural belongings, plural allegiances, and he turns it into a party. Borstal Boy, I think, will be remembered as a conversion narrative. It begins as a rebel novel, as the story of an Irish rebel in an English prison. But it quickly becomes about how that same IRA man learns to love an English sailor, learns to love English literature, and learns to love the English landscape. And I think those are the key texts that he'll be remembered for.
And in a sense, all of them in different ways subversive. And I suppose he was perhaps ultimately a deeply subversive writer.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's we know how unconventional he was in his life. And he was as rebellious and as experimental and as subversive in that in his writings. In everything he does, there's a subversive intent. There's a subversion of form as well. So one of the things that makes the Hostage such an extraordinary play is that he's constantly experimenting with the form, changing the tone of the play, moving from a serious political rebel song to a moment of sexual liberation to a moment of comedy. He never allows one mood to dominate, to sustain. He doesn't allow... almost all of his writings feature death at some point, but he never allows death to have the last laugh.
Let's hear an extract from The Hostage.
Can't we, Wilson?
No, Commandant General.
As you were, Patrick.
Ah, thank you, Monsieur.
Patrick, preparation.
Oh, everything is ready for the guests.
Good, good.
The troops will be coming quite soon.
The troops? Good God. Oh, how many of them are expected then?
There will be the two guards and the prisoner.
The prisoner?
Yes. Yes, we only have the one at the moment, but it's a good beginning.
Oh, yes, indeed. As the Scotchman says, many a mickle makes a muckle.
And as we Irish say, it's one after the other they built the castle. Is in Yigikele, Shethugug on Koshlaw.
God, you hear that, Meg? Huh? That's Irish. Oh, it's a great thing. An Oxford University education, you know me. I'm only a poor ignorant in Dublin, man. I wouldn't understand a word of it. Oh, but about Monsieur, about this prisoner now, Monsieur.
Yes, an English laddie to be captured on the border.
Armagh.
Only one at first, but soon we'll have scores of them.
Oh, I hope the kid isn't going to bring the hall here.
What's that?
I said it's a great thing the boys have been out again, so...
Yeah, absolutely first class. Carry on.
Ah, he's a decent old kid. Even if he has got a slate loose.
God, did you hear that? God's bad enough turning his place into an IRA barracks, but Monsieur wants to make a glass house out of it now.
A what?
A kind of a private Shepton mallet of his own.
We should be proud to help the men that are fighting for Ireland. Especially that poor boy to be hanged in Belfast jail tomorrow morning.
And what are you getting so upset over Ireland? Where the hell were you in 1916 when the real fighting was going on, huh?
I wasn't born yet.
Oh, you're full of excuses. Yeah, where were you when we had to go out and capture our own stuff off at the British Army, huh?
Capture it? You told me you bought it off the Tommies in the pub. You said yourself you got a revolver, 200 rounds of ammunition and a pair of jumpers off a colonel's back.
An extract there from an RTE radio drama production of Brendan Behan's The Hostage. John Brannigan, in the introduction to your book, Brendan Behan, Cultural Nationalism and the Revisionist Writer, you tell this marvellous, probably apocryphal story about Behan setting up office in the burnt-out Abbey Theatre in 1951 and holding court there for several months. True or not, it captures something of his relationship with our national theatre.
It does. I mean, he's a writer who was probably in his own terms awarded the highest honours that his country could give. That is, he was rejected by the Abbey Theatre and he was banned by the Irish Censorship Board. And in many ways, he became successful in London, in New York, in Paris and Berlin. But the success he always craved was in Ireland. And that's the success that he found most difficult to achieve. For him, living in the shadow, if you like, of Joyce and Yeats and O'Casey, it was very difficult to be taken seriously as a writer. And the fact that his fame and celebrity really came internationally rather than back in Ireland was something which ultimately contributed to his downfall and his disappointment, I think.
He writes very interestingly about those early productions of the early plays, the Queer Fellow going on at the Pike Theatre in 1954 and on Gael then going on, I think, in 57. But were it not for the response in England to The Hostage and then in New York, is it fair to say that, you know, he might well have been passed over in terms of being regarded, truly regarded as a dramatist of worth in his own country?
I think that's fair. I think in many ways the writings that were produced in London picked up on a trend that was really emerging and became a successful part of English theatre and writing at the time, which was a tradition of working class writing. And there was very little room for the kind of working class culture that Behan was trying to depict, for the kind of dissident socialist message, really, that Behan was trying to articulate in his writings in Ireland. He found that very difficult to broach. And that may account for the lack of success that he had in Ireland before he became an internationally renowned star, if you like.
Of course, Behan became something of an international star with Joan Littlewood's celebrated 1958 production of The Queer Fella at the Theatre Workshop in Stratford in 1956, a signal moment in post-war British theatre. Here's Littlewood herself on directing that production and getting to know Brendan Behan.
He sent this play, which I think he had... Yes, he'd just written it in Irish, The Queer Fella, and he wrote it very shortly after he came out of jail. And he said, "Aaron, I have a song in it that would draw the heart out of you." And the play came. And it was quite thick, and he obviously hadn't read it back, and he got a few tea stains and beer stains on it. And I read about 5 pages, and it leapt off the page. One didn't have to read any more, and I sent a wire right away, come. We were very broke, and he wired back, and he said, I haven't my fare. So he sent his fare, and he drank it, and he said, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm saving up to be one. And he was meeting some Toronto writers in Ireland at that time, in Dublin. And finally, because we were so hard up, we managed to send him a ticket instead of the money, and he arrived one Saturday afternoon in the bar downstairs where I just met you, and very shy, came with a young painter friend, and I walked in, and I said, well, you're a bit late. And I was very, very loath to do anything to the work, because it flowed with all the things that have since said about his magnificent writing, and I didn't want to tamper, but I had to do the first act without his presence. Now, tomorrow morning, you'll see what we're doing with the first act. And he sat, and he laughed at his own jokes, and at the end he said, oh, Christ, I'm a fucking genius. That was that. And I wondered how he'd, because he didn't bother much about stage directions like most good dramatists. He wasn't bothered about that. It flowed from his pen, and he left it till someone would bring it to life and let it grow. And that's how we came to play the Queer Fellow, and how we became great friends and collaborators.
Director Joan Littlewood there. Dr. John Brannigan, of course, Behan had grown up seeing melodrama and the popular fare of the day at the Queen's Theatre in Dublin. How do we see that style of performance reflected in his work for theatre?
I think what Behan wanted to achieve, particularly in a play like The Hostage, is to marry those traditional forms of working class theatre, which were on the wane in his own lifetime. So the music hall theatre, the melodrama that his uncle P.J. Burke performed in the Queen's Theatre. He wanted to bring those into the modern stage. And that's really a major part of his legacy. But it's also part of the difficulty, if you like, of his reputation now, and the reason why there haven't been that many major productions of his work is because contemporary theatre audiences don't have the same theatrical vocabulary, if you like, as the audiences that Behan was trying to write for. In particular, what he was interested in was a working class theatre, was writing for working class audiences in a theatrical idiom that was familiar to them. And that's something that I think we possibly don't have anymore in the theatre.
I want us to hear an extract from Confessions of an Irish Rebel, a late book, of course, dictated as those later books were, tape recorded and then transcribed. But it's him late on remembering his early days of theatre going, and this is read by David Hurley.
I've been in the theatre business all my life. For one section of my family have been supplying costumes, running theatres and owning cinemas for generations. From the age of 4 I had watched good old melodrama at the Queen's Theatre in Dublin. The O'Grady is as proud a title as any of your earls or dukes, and be damned to you. I may be an English officer, but I'm also an Irish gentleman. And with that, the hero of the play flung the scarlet coat, gold epaulets and all, on the floor. And in a frenzy of fury foaming at the mouth to the cheers and shouts of Up the Republic and croaks of Up, skin the goat, from the more venerable of the multitude, he leapt the high steps of a slip jig on the cloth of scarlet and gold. God bless you, PJ, screeches an old one from the gods. That's me dream out. You'll turn yet. Rory and Sean, my stepbrothers and I, looked round the parterre in a weakness of adoration, wishing there was someone there to tell the people to point from us to the stage and at the centre, glorious against the lights, a strapping lad from Kildare in his lawn shirt and velvet breeches, and to say, see those three kids there and see your man there, the O'Grady, the colonel that's after telling off the other rat of an English officer on the court-martial. Well, he's their uncle. And at the Wicklow wedding, he led the floor. and came out to face his fancy with a smart rap of his buckled shoes and his backhand holding up the tails of his homespun coat and his impudent, lovely head to one side in signal to her to take the floor with him. Shy enough she was till the fiddler ran through the first bit of haste to the wedding when she looked up from the floor, gazed proud and fearless at him, and away they went. "Isn't he the fine man, God bless him?" you'd hear an old one mutter as they rapped their way, she firm and light, and he easy and strong through the hornpipe. A murmur of one fiddle played by the old man in the corner of the kitchen, while the orchestra in the pit looked up in unbegrudging admiration. A fine, lovely man. So he was at that, and never lived to be anything less. And if I say it, as one who shouldn't, the queer fellow got good notices, and was pretty well packed for the 28 performances. And I stood there thinking of my uncle, Paddy J. Bourke, and the times I'd watched him performing in his own melodramas and in the plays of Dion Boucicault.
David Herlihy there reading from Brendan Behan's Confessions of an Irish Rebel. John Branigan, can we turn to Behan's short stories? He didn't write or publish many, only six, I think, in total, but they really show a writer very skilled in that form.
Yes, and I think that's characteristic of much of his early writing. I mean, he was a modernist and experimental Gaelic poet who achieved recognition very early in that form, but then ceased to write poems in Gaelic. He was a very gifted craftsman of the short story form, and his short stories were published in some of the major literary magazines of the time. His first major publication was really in The Bell, which was the chief Irish literary magazine of the time. And he also wrote short radio plays in the early 1950s, which were about the move that many working class people made at the time from the city centre tenements to the suburbs. And those two early radio plays are like prototypes, really, of soap operas of working class life, such as Coronation Street. But they were written 8 years before Coronation Street. So the short stories are part of that era of his life in which he was experimenting with these different forms, perfecting his craft, writing brilliant short stories. The trouble for Brendan Behan was that as a working class writer, he needed to earn a living. And neither short stories nor poetry earned you a living. So he had to move on to the forms which might, such as the novel and such as plays.
One of Behan's most subversive short stories, After the Wake, what is it about that particular story that makes it stand out as unique? And it still has this power to quietly shock expectation.
I think that story, it was published first in Paris in 1951 in a kind of late modernist magazine there. And it's often seen as a story in which Behan is able to give expression, if you like, to his homosexuality or his bisexuality in a way that was simply impossible in anything that would be published in Ireland. And we have some small fragments of Borstal Boy, which were not published in the final novel, which also talk more frankly about his sexuality. The thing about After the Wake is that he really shows us a view of homosexuality that's quite cold, that's quite ruthless, but which depicts homosexuality on a spectrum of sexuality, if you like. So there's no opposition, really, between heterosexuality and homosexuality. And he's very open about that. He's very open about homoerotic seduction, if you like. And that's what makes the short story very important for its time. In other writings, I think he was equally as iconoclastic, if you like, equally as willing to be daring and to be shocking. I think there are moments in The Hostage when sexuality is presented in these kind of frank ways. He begins his unfinished novel, The Catacombs, with the story of a character, Deirdre, coming back from having had an abortion in Bristol. In 1950s Ireland, these were the kind of things which were bound to get you banned and certainly bound to draw criticism and scorn. So that shows you in a way how iconoclastic he was, how dissident he was as a figure in Ireland of the time.
This is a flavour of that story after the wake, read by David Herlihy.
There was a big crowd at the wake. They shook hands with him and told him they were sorry for his trouble. Then they shook hands with his and her other relatives and with me, giving me an understanding smile and a license to mourn my pure unhappy love. Indeed, one old one, far gone in Jemison, said she was looking down on the two of us, expecting me to help him bear up. Another old one, drunker still, got lost in the complications of what might have happened had he died instead of her, and only brought herself up at the tableau, I marrying her, and he blessing the union from on high. At about midnight, they began drifting away to their different rooms and houses, and by 3 o'clock, there was only his mother left with us, steadily drinking. At last she got up, a little shakily on her feet, and proceeding to knock her people, said that they'd left bloody early for blood relatives, but seeing as they'd given her bloody little in life, it was the three of us were best entitled to sit waking. She included me and all. When his mother went, he told me he felt very sore and very drunk and very much in need of sleep. He felt hardly able to undress himself. I had to almost carry him to the big double bed in the inner room. I first loosened his collar to relieve the flush on his smooth cheeks, took off his shoes and socks and pants and short from the supply muscled thighs, the stomach flat as an altar boy's, and noted the golden smoothness of the blonde hair on every part of his firm white flesh. I went to the front room and sat by the fire till he called me. "You must be nearly gone yourself," he said. "You might as well come in and get a bit of rest." I sat on the bed, undressing myself by the faint flickering of the candles from the front room. I fancied our face looking up from the open coffin on the Americans, who, having imported wakes from us, invented morticians themselves.
We must mention as well his Irish language writing on Gael, and then many fine poems. He had a real love of Irish, and his work in Irish is of enduring significance, isn't it?
It is. I think Gaelic is the language that he learned it in prison. He came to it late. He loved going to the Gaeltacht, to the Connemara and the Aran Islands in particular. And he had this kind of paradoxical relationship with Gaelic. He loved writing in it. It was a very intimate language for him, one in which he could express his own sense of identity more confidently, if you like. But he also despised the culture, if you like, of wearing the fauna and having kind of very prominent displays of being a Gaelic speaker. He didn't like that aspect of it. He didn't like the aspect of it being a kind of pretension in any way. And so he, as a working class Dubliner, I think that's quite unusual that he showed this real affinity for Gaeltacht culture. In a way that he didn't, let's say, for what he called the country, for rural Ireland, but he identified very particularly with those margins, if you like, of the west of Ireland, where he saw something that was common between working-class Dubliners, who also felt excluded, if you like, from De Valera's Ireland, and those last extremities, if you like, of Gaelic Ireland that survived.
Let's hear one of those poems, examining indeed something of all of that, anticipating the exodus from the Blasket Islands. And this is read by Cathal Portair.
Jackin ig cínú na Mlascaid, do chean o brian a spalla a nyerteri. Ben arig a vór fe lí na grénia mar glinia, gan bád fe chiol na córha bio o glinia, ach an tullar orga djernach huas imul an doin, har an mlascaid uignach litche. Bein grian in a lí, is ska na hihe a skapu ardu re, is eag tanyav a vuach tre skamul. A mera loma shinche shias halu, hihe skriste brishche bruche falu. Fe host ach cletche na nain e kimulch hartonov, buech lo ve filche kion imrolach fe honus. Sheju na guihe Igluska go bug, lia goris and chalach, four fluch, gan chinna, gan chas, gan chosinch. Mont joy, ni jeg, dahida hocht. A jackin keens for the blasket. Sunset and the wide sea will be laid out like glass. No sailing boats or signs of life. Just a last eagle that glints on the world's edge, separate, circling over the lonely, spent blasket. The sun sunk down and night shadows scattered over the high moon, herself scaling the ground with bare, outstretched fingers, cold on the broken houses, the life's scaffold. All silent but the birds' bellies sliding over the waves, glad to be home, head tucked snug in breast, the wind's breath rocking the door, and the damp hearth, fireless, heatless, unwatched. Translated from the Irish by Sean Hewitt.
Brendan Behan's poem, Jackin a Queen Una Mlasked there, Cathal Portair reading. An edition, a special edition of the Irish University Review coming out in May, John Branigan, and many fascinating articles about Brendan Behan there. Frank McGuinness writing about the plays in his article, St. Behan, and making all kinds of connections right up to Joe Orton and the text of Janet Behan's play, Brendan and the Chelsea, in there as well. And we'd hear from Janet Behan later on in the programme. Overall, for you, what emerges from that publication, what emerges in relation to an overall, a bigger picture now, looking at Behan as a writer in a bigger span of time?
I think the main focus of the journal issue was to, if you like, shift the focus away from Behan's reputation as a self-destructive drinker, as an iconoclastic rebel, and really get back to examining what is it about Behan the writer that we should remember, that we should celebrate, that we should want to see produced in our theatres and published in our bookshops and so on. And for me, I think we're very proud as a journal to publish Janet Behan's play, Brendan at the Chelsea, for the first time. The poet Andrew McNeely introduces and annotates some of Behan's newspaper accounts of his time on the Aran Islands, which are very special. I think Frank McGuinness's assessment, having, you know, a master playwright's assessment of Behan's talents as a dramatist, is a very important piece for us in reassessing the legacy of Behan the writer. And then we've also got in this issue new scholarly work on The Hostage, particularly on the relationship between Ongeal and The Hostage. New scholarly work on the language of Borstal Boy, on Behan's success in New York, and also a very frank assessment of how Behan himself narrated his own addiction to alcohol. So I think there's nothing we're shying away from, if you like, in Behan's reputation. We don't want to leave aside the problems that he had with alcohol, the illness that he experienced, and so on. But we want to focus attention on what is it about Behan the writer that still speaks to us, that's still meaningful to us in Ireland now.
It's striking that he and Sean O'Casey died in the same year. In ways, you know, in many ways, very different men and very different writers, but with a shared passion and a very much a loved landscape of Dublin. But there is a certain commonality as well, is there not, in some of the writing, and especially in the work for theatre?
There is. I mean, he commented in one of his letters, I think, that all of his characters were from O'Casey's battalion. He's very conscious of writing in the shadow of O'Casey and in a way that was not overpowering or overwhelming, I think, in the same way that Joyce or Yeats were. O'Casey, he felt he could learn from and he could develop his art in relation to O'Casey. He learns the same abilities, if you like, to bring tragicomedy to the stage and to hold those two things in tension, to have the tears and the laughter on stage at the same time.
Can we see any distinct line of influence from Behan as a writer? I suppose, you know, I would think of somebody perhaps like Roddy Doyle and some of his early plays, and indeed some of the novels have some of the verve and originality and kind of fearless confidence of Behan. And I suppose, again, Frank McGuinness in place and in places seems to have a kind of a smack of some of the go of Behan.
I think he's very much there in contemporary Irish writing, perhaps in ways that aren't fully acknowledged. But I think his experimentalism, the risks that he took in some of his works have been valuable lessons, I think, for writers today. And I think, of course, there's always the reputation of, you know, a road that writers shouldn't take. You know, there's the celebrity Behan, the alcoholic Behan, who I think has been a sort of a warning sign for writers, a sort of self-destructive image in the same sort of line as Dylan Thomas or Phil Lynott or Kurt Cobain that writers obviously need to avoid. But there's much from Behan's art, much of his skill as a writer, which I think has been passed on, much of his dissident outlook on Irish society, which is still there in Irish literature today.
So for you, Brendan Behan remains a deeply relevant writer for us today.
I think he's a very powerful figure still for us today and still has a lot to tell us about the society that we live in. And I think it's going back to Behan the writing, Behan the writer, rediscovering Behan really as a master craftsman of many of the forms that he experimented with that I would like to see us do this year.
Dr. John Brannigan, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Arts Tonight. We're paying tribute to Brendan Behan on the 50th anniversary of his death. Coming up, Janet Behan on the challenge of writing an honest picture of her uncle, and actor-director Adrian Dunbar on honouring that complex portrait. Welcome back to Arts Tonight on this St. Patrick's Night. We're remembering Brendan Behan 5 decades after his death. Behan inhabited many landscapes, real, imaginary, psychic and sexual. One city he loved and adopted as a home from home was New York. And in the early 1960s, he lived for several months at the famous Chelsea Hotel there. He wrote about that time in the book Brendan Behan's New York, published after his death, a book with marvellous drawings by Paul Hogarth and still a brilliant insight into the city of the Bowery, church, synagogue and the Statue of Liberty.
The Hotel Chelsea is a marvellous institution and is lovingly called by a great many people the Dowager of 23rd Street, because as far as I know it is the oldest building there and is the heart and home of the street. Built entirely of red brick, it is rather a splendid example of late Victorian architecture, and every one of the 10 floors has a beautiful little balcony of cast iron. I had an apartment there which was extremely comfortable. For nearly 100 years, many famous people have either lived or stayed there, and it was the hotel that the late Dylan Thomas occupied when he was in New York. And I am told by his wife, Kathleen, that it was the one where he was most happy. The Lord have mercy on him, for he died in St. Vincent's Hospital, a little way down the street. To praise the wonderful work of Dylan Thomas would be an impertinence, but it is overshadowed by his adventures in the drinking line, if you can call drink an adventure, that is. However, the Hotel Chelsea respects him as a great artist, and I would hope that Mr. Bard, the proprietor, and his son Stanley, who has a beautiful baby daughter, would leave space on their plaque for myself.
From Brendan Behan's New York, that reading by David Herlihy. The hotel, made famous by Leonard Cohen, among others, is the setting for the play Brendan at the Chelsea by Janet Behan, Brendan Behan's niece. In the most recent Lyric Theatre production, Adrian Dunbar played the part of Brendan Behan and also directed the play. Janet Behan and Adrian Dunbar came into studio in London, and Janet Behan told me how she came to write Brendan at the Chelsea.
Well, it came out of originally a commission to write a stage adaptation of Brendan Behan's New York, which didn't prove particularly theatrical, as it's a travelogue, basically, and a book of anecdotes. But I had set one scene in the Chelsea Hotel in New York, and somebody said to me, "You need to set the whole play there," which I said, "Oh, no, that's completely impossible." Because it would have meant a lot of work. But anyway, I said, "I'll go away for a month and try it." So I went away for a month and tried it. And basically what the play is now came out of that process. And it stopped being called Brendan Behan's New York, and it became Brendan at the Chelsea.
I remember actually when I went to New York for the first time in 1987, I brought with me Brendan Behan's New York as my guidebook to the city. And almost 25 years on from publication, of course it was published after he died, a year after he died, it remained this wonderful guide to the place. And he seems to have been very happy there, and particularly happy, Janet, in the Chelsea Hotel.
Yeah, well, I think the Chelsea, and particularly Stanley Bard, rescued him. Really, I think he was broke, he was in a terrible physical condition, and he had been thrown out of his previous lodgings. And what happened was that he was in his Bernard Geiss's office, that's his publisher's office, saying, what do I do now? And Catherine Dunham, the doyenne of Black Dance at that time, was in there, and she said, I know what to do, we'll fix him up at the Chelsea, which is what she did. And he was very well looked after there, yeah.
I know you were very young when Brendan died, but did you absorb anything from him or his spirit in the family that helped you to write the play?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, the whole family was informed by his fame. And, you know, in general, my father and my uncle Dominic and Brendan were in the papers a lot. My father was a socialist agitator in London at the time. And there was a lot of stuff in the papers with the battling Behan brothers, blah, 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 all that kind of thing the whole time. And I think it left me with a sense that it was a very sad thing to grow up and not be famous, which is it kind of informs the play in a way, that examination of what fame and what the expectation of fame does to people, which, of course, you know, in today's celebrity society and culture is very relevant.
Did your father, Brian, speak much about Brendan?
Yes, he did. Sometimes lovingly, and sometimes not. They were a complicated set of brothers, and their relationships with each other were very complicated. I blame the granny myself, but that's another story.
Yes, obviously a remarkable woman. Was it hard for you as his niece to create a kind of artistic distance from Brendan Behan as a subject? Was there a danger at all of slight hero worship, and I know you didn't go into that, or a softening of the stage portrayal of him through, I suppose, love and a kind of family deference?
Yes, I think probably the first 7 or 8 drafts, I was rather like a sort of a Vestal Virgin worshipping at the shrine, and there was no drink, there was no bad behaviour, there was just his beautiful words on display for the world to admire, you know. But in the end, if you can't be honest about a person, you're not really doing them any favours. And, you know, I wanted the whole man. I wanted the complicated man, you know, with all his problems and all his marvellousness to be on the stage. So,
Adrian Dunbar, you brought that marvellous and complex man to vivid life on the stage, directing the lyric production of Brendan at the Chelsea and playing Brendan in it, and really making this complex and deeply moving picture of Behan. I presume he's somebody you very much admired in life.
Yeah, I admire people who kind of apparently have no constituency, and yet they seem to come out of nowhere, and you know, and they're very complicated. And like Brendan was complicated, you know, working class, no formal education, you know, an alcoholic, homosexual, you know, with a terrible stammer, and here he is with his granny going around Dublin, who'll pop him up on a pub table and tell him to recite Emmett's speech from the dock, which he can do with a stammer, and he finds a way of speaking to compensate for that. I mean, desperately complicated person who doesn't have a constituency to support him because he didn't go through the formal education system. He ended up in Borstal, as we know, after, you know, joining the IRA, and with his Republican background, wanting to do something to further the cause of a 32-county Ireland, finds himself in Borstal. And this, you know, free Borstal governor decides to stick him in the library. And when he's there, he completes his education by reading the books, but not only doing that, but by criticising them and analysing them and having this, you know, terribly precocious talent. And from there, he goes on to be, you know, a world-renowned writer. So, you know, he's a very big and powerful figure outside of Ireland as well as inside. And so to try and pull all that together and to get a sense of that, I think that Janet did a fabulous job in setting it in the Chelsea so that we were outside of Ireland, so that we could, you know, understand Brendan a little clearer. And also, you know, the... she wrote a play that was very like a Behan play. It's very like that kind of, you know, Brechtian style of Behan writing. And so, you know, once I saw the play and did a rehearsed reading of it at the National, I felt Janet and I should work together on it. And that's what, you know, how the process started.
As a writer yourself and director and actor, do you admire Behan's work, in particular his work for stage, you know, plays like The Queerfellow and The Hostage and Richard's Cork Leg? And there's that great moment of the play where, you know, once again he kind of denounces this perception that, you know, he was writing under Littlewood, under the direction of Joan Littlewood, as if he couldn't write by himself.
I think his plays are very powerful. I said I was thinking the other day, Vincent, precisely about this point about Joan Littlewood. In, you know, when I've talked to people who work there at Stratford East, they said, yes, Brendan would bring in the scenes that he had written the night before, and the dialogue that came out of everybody's mouth was absolutely bang on, and, you know, the themes and everything was there. But moving things around, stage directions, he didn't pay much attention to that. And so therefore what he did was he set up something that actually has now become quite... you know, an understood thing in the theatre. It's now a convention in the theatre that's very, very acceptable, where writers come in and they work on their play in rehearsal. And through the rehearsal process, you get something that kind of ends up on the stage. But Brendan started that in a way, but it's not only that. I mean, what's important about him, I believe, is the fact that he was probably the first writer who put the big issues of the day into the mouths of the working classes, without someone who was sort of their better or whatever to come in and actually contextualise it for them. So there you have in The Queerfellow a bunch of people talking about capital punishment, you know, and there isn't any kind of, you know, governmental view. There isn't any teacher to come in and kind of throw a shape on it. There isn't. These are people working things out for themselves. And that's a very important thing. And that's why his work translated to other countries in the world. And it's only when we get to America that we realise how the Americans saw him as part of the true avant-garde, someone who was working in a Brechtian sense, who was working in a very working-class way to bring these issues to the people. And actually, he was there with the beat poets in the village, talking to them about all the issues of the day. And Norman Mailer said that when Brendan's play The Hostage became a hit on Broadway, it legitimised the beat movement. Now, that's a very important statement for us to understand, and shows the breadth of him as a writer and a person and how he was seen abroad. And I think, you know, maybe there's some way we could go to readdressing all that there and redefining and repositioning Brendan in the next, you know, couple of years or so.
You're listening to Arts Tonight. We're remembering Brendan Behan on the 50th anniversary of his death. Our guests, Adrian Dunbar and Janet Behan, Brendan Behan's niece. Let's hear an extract from the Lyric Theatre production of Brendan at the Chelsea by Janet Behan, with Adrian Dunbar as Brendan Behan.
New York is the greatest show on earth, the most astonishing, fabulous place. So fabulous, in fact, that if you want my opinion, the whole town, along with the 20 million people in it, are to be investigated by a committee for being jolly.
You're clearly enjoying that cigar, Brendan. Is it a Havana?
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. A very expensive smoker created by Fidel Castro in communist Cuba. An enjoyable smoke, allowing you, as it does, to feel radical and bourgeois at the same time. A very natural ambition for any member of the working classes.
An extract there from the Lyric Theatre production of Brendan at the Chelsea by Janet Behan, Adrian Dunbar playing Brendan Behan very memorably indeed. Adrian, did you feel that you got to know Behan better through that performance? And it should be said that it's no rose-tinted picture of his life or his personality.
Yes, I did. I think I got to know him quite a bit. It isn't a rose, because he was complicated. And you know, he was an alcoholic. And, you know, alcohol makes us do stuff that's sometimes, you know, quite nasty and brutish. And, you know, and he, you know, was responsible for some terrible things. However, you know, that shouldn't stop us from seeing through that and seeing through the kind of mean-spiritedness that sometimes manifests itself through alcohol and see through it into kind of what his work was like and what his work did. So I feel I did get to know him. I felt that, you know, there was a... The fact that he doesn't have a constituency in Ireland has been to his detriment. The working classes, of course, you know, have never lost faith in him and will come and see his plays all the time. But, you know, it was a pity. I was very pleased to hear Frank McGuinness recently say that we should start to look at Brendan again and have a look at his plays and, you know, reassess the worth of the plays, etc. You know, but when I was in New York, Vincent, I was meeting people from all over the world who were, you know, who can remember doing Brendan's plays in the 60s. And, you know, so that noise, that bang of his, you know, his fame had spread right across the globe by that stage. And because Ireland was so insular in many respects, I don't think we have yet woken up to that. So it would be nice to see that.
One thing I wanted to talk to you as well, Janet, about is a theme in the play. You know, you don't shy away from your uncle's bisexuality. And in that play, you know, we see his relationship with the sailor from Dundalk and his ease in the kind of louche sexual milieu of the Chelsea Hotel. Was that subject in any way controversial within your own family?
Yes, it was extremely controversial. I mean, I guess while Beatrice was alive, for obvious reasons. But also, I mean, I remember my father coming out in print when the most recent biography came out, which clearly states that he was a homosexual. You know, and in print he said that this was a terrible slander, but he also wrote a document for me before he died saying if he was writing a play about Brendan Behan, it would be about his affair with Peter Arthurs in New York. So it was clearly known within the family that he was bisexual, but, it, you know, they didn't want it talked about by other people, no.
What kind of response have you had to the play? You know, it's been seen in London, in New York and in Dublin, in Belfast. I mean, do people respond well to that vision of Brendan, free in a sense, outside of Ireland and in a very particular space and time in New York?
You know, when we first put the play on in Hammersmith in 2008 at the Riverside Studios, I was absolutely terrified because the thing is that Brendan always evokes a strong response in Irish people, that, especially of a certain generation that remember him and knew him, etc., etc. And I was overwhelmed by how much there are a lot of Irish people live in Hammersmith and a lot of them came to the play and they absolutely loved it and they loved him. I mean, that's the strange thing, is it is, as you say, a warts and all performance, but they were queuing up for Adrian Dunbar's autograph afterwards, I can tell you. Absolutely loved it and were absolutely alongside with the portrayal of him. It's very strange. It's what Adrian was saying about forgiveness, you know, when you see the whole of a person, you know, then you it strikes a chord in yourself, doesn't it, really? And you think, yeah, we're human. We're all stumbling. We're all falling, you know.
Some critics looking at Brendan Behan's work now will say that his too early death perhaps prevented him from writing more and left a smaller quantity of work on which to assess him and on which to try to base and build a legacy. But Janet, you make a point that quite a lot of his writing was destroyed and in particular writing he'd done in prison.
Yeah, I mean, that he had important friends outside of prison who were, well, they weren't friends, they were like patrons, I suppose, who were writing to the prison authorities saying, this man has talent, this man is important to this country, please can we publish some of his work? And it was always no. So given the amount of time that he spent in prison, you know, you're talking about a lot of work that just never saw the light of day. So, you know, if he'd been outside, he'd have been like any other young writer making his way and we'd have all that beautiful stuff. But, you know.
Adrian, you'd mentioned Frank McGuinness saying it's time to you know, make this assessment, reassessment of Brendan Behan's work. And of course, he's one of the people contributing to this forthcoming issue of the Irish University Review, which has many fine articles on Brendan Behan's writing, on his legacy, on how we should regard him now. For you, what is the abiding value of Brendan Behan's literary legacy in particular to us now?
Work, there's a wonderful sense of where he comes from. There's a wonderful sense of, you know, everything about the dialogue and the duologues within his work rings true to me. He's very, very honest about society and about himself. And, you know, it's a window into the past for us these days, and we should be looking at it and remembering. And, you know, it's... You know, nostalgia is great, as Brando said. It's the most powerful drug of the lot. So his plays do tend to be very powerful in that respect. But there are lots of lessons for us there. And, you know, and it would be a great thing that Brendan becomes the person who reinstates to us a part of us that may have been lost. And, you know, for that, I thank him a lot.
Janet, do you feel a strong sense of connection to him at all?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And especially as a result of writing the play, I feel very, very mixed up with him, you know, and with my daddy who's gone now, and the last of the brothers, Uncle Seamus, died about 3 weeks ago. Unfortunately, I was out of the country, so I couldn't go to his funeral. But there's a great sense in which the family is kind of, I don't know, coming back together and everything, and you know. Yes, I do. And I'd just like to say that there are stories in After the Wake, a collection of his stories that are so beautiful. Yeah. And when you think of the time that he wrote them, stories about homosexual love, stories about adulterous relationships, and there's a very moving story about an IRA murder, which he writes in the first person. I pray to God that's not because he's writing from personal experience, but there's a point at which they're filling in the grave over the man's head, and there was a big rock, and he said, I moved the rock because I didn't want to smash his face. And just it's that kind of really deep, down to the core honesty of the man. And I mean honesty in a literary sense, that I think is exceptional and tinged with genius, shall we say.
Can I ask you both if you feel Brendan Behan is getting enough attention in this anniversary year, you know, 50 years since his death, is due attention being paid to him, especially in Ireland, Janet?
Well, he's on a stamp, which I think he would have thought was very funny, you know, him and the Queen. I think you'd have thought that was hysterical. It seems to me that he is getting the attention that he's due. Perhaps not in England.
Adrian.
Yeah, I think he is. We're about to do a documentary on RTE about Brendan. But what I would like to see is the plays being done in Dublin. I'd like to see, you know, a really good season. It might be nice if the Abbey would do a Behan season. Or, you know, that type of thing. I think a proper look at the plays with a company of actors and good directors and so forth would be a fabulous thing if it happened.
Adrian Dunbar, Janet Behan, thanks to you both. The text of Brendan at the Chelsea will be published in the forthcoming special issue of the Irish University Review, edited by Dr. John Brannigan of UCD. His book, Brendan Behan, Cultural Nationalism and the Revisionist Writer, is published by Four Courts Press and is just out in paperback. Most of Brendan Behan's works are still in print, including a collection of his stories and prose writings, After the Wake, edited by Peter Fallon and published by the O'Brien Press. As Adrian Dunbar said there, it would be very good to see a revival of the plays, and surely some public forum of debate, discussion, acknowledgement of the twin legacies of Behan and O'Casey is called for during this year. Whatever voices may be heard as part of that or any other forum, none richer or more unique than Brendan Behan's own. We leave you with the voice of Behan and one of his great ironic songs of fading empire, The Captains and the Kings. Till next week, good night.
I'll have to sing this song in an Oxford accent. You haven't any idea of my Oxford accent? Well, you'll shortly will.
I remember in September when the final stumps were drawn and the shouts of crowds now silent and the boys to tea have gone. Let us, O Lord above us, still remember simple things when all are dead who love us, O the captains and the kings. When all are dead who love us, O the captains and the king. We have many goods for export, Christian ethics and old port, but our greatest boast is that the Anglo-Saxon is a sport. When the darts game is finished, and the boys the game of rings, and the draughts and chess relinquished, all the captains and the kings, and the draughts and chess relinquished, all the captains and the kings. Far away in dear old Cyprus, or in Kenya's dusty land, where we bear the white man's burden in many a strange land. As we look across our shoulder in West Belfast, the school bell rings, and we sigh for dear old England and the captains and the kings. And we sigh for dear old England and the captains and the kings.
The inimitable Brendan Behan singing his own composition, The Captains and the Kings, from his play The Hostage, ending tonight's edition of Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods and produced by Aileen O'Mara for Digital Audio Productions. And you can listen back to that edition of the programme on the RTE radio player, available online at rte.ie. A reminder that Arts Tonight is repeated on Wednesday mornings at 4, and you can podcast it too on our website, rte.ie/radio1/artstonight.